studying what the Hindu calls the Kamarupa, or desire body of man. First of all, we should point out that there is not complete agreement even among the Indian schools as to the meaning of this term or the reasonable extensions of it in the study of man's superphysical construction. Therefore, what we have tried to do is to synthesize and create as far as possible a composite picture of the several different basic schools of thought. And where it seems essential, we will point out these differences. The word itself, Kamarupa, is composed of two words of the Indian language, kama, which literally means desire, and rupa, which means body or form. Therefore, it is the body or form of desire. Yet even in the Indian schools, we find that the word desire is subject to a number of modifications. Included among the synonyms for this term, in this usage, is volition. And this has quite a different meaning to our thinking than the simple problem of desire. Yet, as we go further, we shall observe a number of parallels between the Hindu schools and the rising concepts of Western psychology, especially as these relate to the anima-animus problem, which seemingly is founded in the study of this vehicle of man. We have pointed out already that the constitution of man consists of a series of bodies of which the physical alone is visible. That these bodies are each of them derived from a plane or substance which exists in nature, in the universe, and in the atmosphere, visible and invisible, of our own planet. Thus a rupa or a body must always be formed around certain vortices or centers of energy, and it will be formed by the materials available in the great reservoir of natural substances, materials in each case upon the level or plane of the body itself. This means that in Indian thinking, man's desires arise not essentially from a spiritual being, but from a body, and that desire on its own level is not so different from the creature comfort problem of the physical body. The physical body has certain needs, certain demands, and a kind of existence of its own. It must be supplied and served, and always the master is the servant of his own servant. And this is true in the case of the emotional or desire nature just as much as it is of the physical. We've also pointed out that the body of desire, per se, is associated with the physical body through the corresponding etheric instrument. And we devoted, I think, sufficient time last week to the study of this etheric binding principle so that we need not repeat here. The Kamarupa is divisible, usually, into two parts, which are termed higher and lower. These correspond to what is termed the plane of natural desire substance, which is a plane of molecular energy. In the cosmological systems of the Hindus, the desire or karmic plane is divisible into an upper and lower part, the upper part being called Devachan and the lower part Kamaloka. Now these two planes represent, to our way of thinking, something of the story unfolded in Dante's story of the Inferno, or the Divine Comedy. Here we find Dante ascending from the Purgatorio to the Paradiso. or from purgatory to paradise. And in Indian thinking, Devachan is equivalent to paradise, and Kamaloka is equivalent to purgatory. Now, the reason why Kamaloka, or the lower part of the plane of desire, is likened to a sphere of punishment, I think we all begin to understand better perhaps today, when we know more of man's psychological structure than we did 50 years ago. We all realize, even in our daily living, that there is a relationship between volition and desire, on the one hand, and the condition in which we live, on the other. In other words, the individual is constantly punished, even here, if his desire structure or his desire impulses become unreasonable. The average person can take a comparatively pleasant and harmonious environment and destroy it by his own emotional excess. We all know this to be true, that unless we govern, direct, control, and integrate emotions, they can become a tremendous cause of difficulty. In Europe, where Eastern philosophy drifted into Western thinking, particularly through the Gnostics, Neoplatonists, and other early sects, there was gradually developed a term which later in the French school of Transcendentalism was called the astral light. Now, the astral light is an interesting thought because the word astral, of course, comes from star. The word deva comes from the root meaning to shine. And there is a great deal of similarity between certain Eastern and Western concepts. The astral light of Western magic and Western transcendentalism was the great sphere of illusion. And in Eastern philosophy, the tamic sphere, or the sphere of desire, is associated with this. Therefore, it was assumed by Buddhism, particularly, that desires are the basis of an illusionary, or an imaginary, or a fantastic relationship between creatures and facts. Each individual, therefore, suffers from the distorting effects of his own emotional coloring. For this reason, the sphere of desire, or the kamic sphere, was also identified with the deity Mara, the god of illusion, and the tempter of Buddha. Desire is forever luring the individual to that which is its inevitable correlative, the gratification of the desire. And therefore, in the study of man, we find this principle, this body within him, this structure within his own nature, by which all of his desires are activated. And furthermore, that the desires themselves are engendered within the mystery of this region of fantasy. Thus, in the average person, the Kamarupa is the body of fantasy, the body of imagination. It is connected in Indian philosophy with the moon because of the inconstancy of the light of this luminary. It is the part of man which gives him great happiness one moment and great misery the next. It is the inevitable energy within him which causes him to like some things without reason and to dislike others on the same basis. We have mentioned before in various discussions that for the average person, the principal motivation for living is desire. This passes through a series of refinements. Some desire only good things, others are not so particular. But in any event, desire is the motivation. The desire to live, as Buddha points out, is the basis of the great cycle of necessity, or the cycle of rebirth. Desire must consequently be considered the most powerful force in the life of man today. It is the force which causes the activation of practically all superior factors or faculties within the constitution. As we have also pointed out, thought follows desire. It does not lead it in the present constitution of the human being. and without interest, which is a form of desire, without emotional coloring, like or dislike, without the motivation of hope or fear or faith or belief, without these circumstances, man remains comparatively inactive. It is therefore only through the pressure of certain coloring within himself that he is led to depart from comparative inertia. Practically every achievement of mankind that is commendable has been built upon faith or hope, both of which are forms of desire material. The greatest crimes that have been committed against humanity have been committed in the name of ambition, or in the name of greed, or in the name of tyranny, which are also emotional excesses. Once these excesses dominate in a life, the mind is used as the instrument for the rational solution of the ambitions or the aggressions which the desire has stimulated. It must naturally follow, then, that in the constitution of man, the desire nature is an extremely important one, and its action upon all other parts of the personality are dominant in the majority of cases. It also follows that the desire nature, which is the mainspring of the volitional attitude of man in his present state, must be the cause of innumerable consequences. Therefore, kamma and karma are closely linked. Where there is no kamma, there is no karma. Where there is no desire, there is no consequence. The relationship of these two is exceedingly vital. Now, the emotional body, or the desire body, the kamarupa, is also the basis of two other general terms, expressions of man's life. These are summarized under the simple statement that kamma is the source of both motion and emotion. In other words, desire is at the root of motion, and things move because of desires, perhaps two dominant, contrary desires. One desire being to approach in order perhaps to possess, the other being to depart or to escape. Therefore, in the life of man, motion is the result of the desire to survive. It is also the result of the desire to attain, to possess, to do. Gradually the hands of man came into existence because of what we call need. Need is rooted in desire. And wherever there is motion, there is some degree of desire. Motion in its completest form is found in the animal kingdom, where we find the animal instinctively and inevitably moving in accordance to instinct or impulse. In man, movement is to a degree subordinated to the mind or to the purposes of the individual. He may be by nature and desire a rolling stone, but he has discovered that it is more necessary to his survival that he learn to stay in one place, learn to labor, and to moderate his natural instincts and impulses. Thus, the impulse to move and the impulse of emotion, which is to possess in some sense of the word, these two are the principal elements of the kamic nature. The vehicle of kamma, particularly in the body of man, is the blood. And through the blood, the desire principle is disseminated completely throughout the structure of the body. Its seat and particular center in man is the great lobe of the liver. And therefore, wherever we find a creature with warm blood, a creature possessing the power of motion, we find a being endowed with an emotional body, although this may be in a comparatively undeveloped state. The study of the kamarupa as it relates to man may begin with a consideration of it according to the Hindu philosophy. We know that in their system, generally speaking, the kamarupa is the first of the superior vehicles of man, which has a permanent or relatively permanent existence. The etheric body, the vital energy field, must survive the body, as we said last week, but it survives for only a short time. It is not a permanent body. It is not a vehicle. And it is gradually separated from the superior vehicles along with the physical body, of which it is essentially a part. For ether and matter are merely octaves of each other. Actually, therefore, the Kamarupa is the so-called body of man after death. It is that vehicle which has a continuance. And in the ancient beliefs, it gradually took on certain attributes or aspects of the physical body, but was somewhat larger and less perfectly integrated from a structural standpoint. During life, it is described as a field of light surrounding the body and extending from 8 to 12 inches in an oval form, its great vortex or center being in juxtaposition to the liver. Within this body will be observed the gradually developing structure of organs. These organs, as in all such structures in nature, begin with vortices, or whirling chakras of energy, and these gradually develop according to the development and growth of the physical personality. In Hindu philosophy, the Kamarupa is the result of man's experience. The substance from which it is composed is natural, but just as man must extend a principle into matter in order to create a physical body from the substances around him, so man must extend certain principles into the material of the desire world, and around these principles of vortices gather the material for this body. And this process of the generation of the so-called Kamarupa is tremendously influenced by the growth and development of the emotional life of the human being. It is said that the principle of Kama dominates life until the seventh year. After that, the individual begins to gradually dominate, mold, and modify the kamic body, which reaches its greatest degree of intensity about the 14th year. The Kamarupa, then, being a body of desire, is also essentially fashioned from experience. The purpose of life is experience. The purpose of emotional activity is that the individual shall learn. And that which he must learn, regardless of his inclinations, is the moderation of all powers and faculties. Because only through their moderation can they be sublimated. And only through sublimation can they be reconciled. And the composite chain of vehicles become one consecutive and consistent organization. The next point to remember is that as man's after-death experience is transferred to the Kamarupa, so it becomes a kind of body world in which the individual exists. We know that it is composed of the materials of the kamic plane or world, just as the material body is of the elements of the earth. But these materials forming the kamic body have certain differences from those which we know physically. For example, in the kamic body there is no necessity for objective sensory perceptions, as in the case of physical existence. There is no need for the power to see, or the power to hear, or the power to taste. These senses are necessary in a certain environment. In the kamic sphere, such functions, such faculties, have no value because of the nature of that world, and because the contact in that world is entirely upon the level of desire or emotion vibration. Also, we should bear in mind that the human entity, the ego, passing into the after-death state, and, for instance, entering into its own desire structure, entering into its own kama rupa, and becoming polarized there, as it is was earlier polarized physically, becomes, so to say, a sovereign over a sphere, just as the incarnating entity becomes a kind of sovereign over the physical body. This sphere, however, of kama rupa is very different, and we have no simple method of explaining it to you, except perhaps by analogy. And we must remember that all analogies have a measure of imperfection in them. Similes, parables, allegories are delightful things if we do not overwork them. But they cannot be carried beyond a certain degree. Therefore, we can only generalize by means of them. Perhaps then, the best way in which we can symbolize the existence of a being in the kamarupa is to have a parallel in the dream life of man. Now, in a dream fantasy, or to that degree, into a certain highly developed waking fantasy, or daydreaming, the individual discovers dimensions which are totally beyond physical estimation. He discovers, for example, that in his subjective dream life, that he enters into himself and at the same time seems to enter into a vast world. He does not really know or experience the fact that this world that he visits in dreams, a world ever-changing, kaleidoscopic in its potentials, a world of motion, light, color. He is entering into a sphere of internalization. Perhaps in his dream he may travel to far countries, climb mountains, or fly over valleys, but all of these things are actually taking place within his own karmic field. He is never leaving this field. In his dream he may meet persons who have been dead for ages. He is not meeting them, he is meeting his own emotional images of them. He may at the same time face extraordinary hazards. He may come upon enemies. He may find himself on a battlefield with armies. He may be surrounded by millions of other persons, as in a great pageant of some nature. Or he may find himself shipwrecked upon a vast ocean, the boundaries of which are beyond his vision or his sense. Yet all of these immensities, whether of heaven and earth, whether of number or quality, all of these things are taking place within the mysterious mirror of his own astral shape or shadow. His dream world never extends, under usual conditions, outside of his own fantasy. But he discovers that his fantasy is immeasurable. It cannot be limited or circumscribed. In his fantasy, he can visit the most distant star and seemingly live there. In his fantasy, he can speak all languages. In his fantasy, he can be placed under the most terrible hazards or elevated to the greatest dignities. He may not be alone. He may be in any kind of a world that his own desires have brought into being. In your psychological study, we know, for instance, the importance of various dreams in which the individual, due to his own neurotic condition or to such psychotic states as may have developed within him, is subject to symbolic or even archetypal dreams, dreams which are curiously related to the frustration of his emotions, to the intensities of his desires, and these desires taking symbolic forms are revealed to him, as Freud pointed out, through imagery, which must be interpreted, because the real meaning is not immediately apparent. Now, it would be understandable, therefore, that if an entity, submerged temporarily in its own astral body, should be able to return and describe the circumstances of such a journey to other persons in a material, objective life, that his story might be as strange as any account given by Emanuel Swedenborg, or any of the wonders of the summer land described by Andrew Jackson Davis. he would be quite certain that he had been placed to places, that he had seen shining temples on the tops of hills, that he had seen figures robed in white, that he had gone somewhere where there were mountains and rivers and streams, and like the happy hunting ground of the old Indian warrior, that he had actually entered a place. Yet another seer or mystic of similar ability would bring back a totally different description of this place. A good Muslim, under the conditions of such a mystical adventure, would probably come back with a full description of Muhammad's paradise to come. A good Presbyterian would undoubtedly come back with a slightly different account. We know that the Hindu might definitely find himself on the broad path leading up to the crest of Mount Meru, where the devas and gods dwelt together. The atheist would probably wander around in a hole in the dark, because he's certain that that is all that there is, and he would undoubtedly insist upon finding out in this space nothing but himself. He probably would deny his own existence, but be unable to account why it was that, not existing, he was able to remember so clearly that he did not exist. All of which is a peculiar situation. Now, in the Greek and ancient mystery rites, there are descriptions of these great herds of souls moving in space. And Dante describes the sleepers in the caverns under the earth who sleep through the ages because they believed in death. All of these experiences occur not in a place, but within the tremendous internal emotional potential of living things. Emotion is therefore a very fluidic and mysterious quality. And nearly all of the emotions that we feel are rooted in the subjective emotions that we have built up through the ages in the processes of living. Our emotions, as we express them objectively, therefore, are a form of dream symbolism brought through into action, causing us to love this, to hate that, to desire something else, because of the pressures that lie within this emotional scope itself. During our physical life, the emotions move through us. During the metaphysical experience of man after death, according to the Hindus, he moves through his own emotional life. He lives in it. He has no existence apart from it. It becomes the new house in which he lives. But in many instances, in fact in most instances, it is a haunted house, because it is filled with the inevitable consequences of desire intensity. We can begin to appreciate this also psychologically. We know what bad emotional habits will do to a person in the course of 30 or 40 years. What is an emotional habit? Is an emotional habit merely an automatic physical thing? The Hindu would say no. But the emotional habit is the actual building of a kind of entity, a geometrical, vibratory being within the structure of the emotional life. And therefore, that gradually, the emotions, if seriously perverted or wrongly educated over a period of time, become tyrants and begin to project their own emotion patterns and forms upon the objective life. To a degree, therefore, what we call disease has its emotional equivalent, because in the emotional sphere, what we call disease causes various evils, obstructions, tumors, and things of that nature, what we now call such emotional growths, complexes, or fixations, or something of that nature. But actually, they exist, built up and sustained and intensified by our own emotional pressures. It is from this concept, and all that relates to it, of course, that we have gradually fashioned our image of the devil. The devil, of course, is the total pressure of desire on the negative level. He is usually represented as dressed in red because he is vested in the human blood. And also, as Mephisto points out in Faust, when he signs his pact with Faust, Mephisto says to the old philosopher alchemist, "Sign this pact with blood, for blood is a most peculiar essence." and blood becomes the carrier of this chemic pressure. And the individual, moved by his own negative emotional pressures, resulting in acts of evil, is said, therefore, to be under the influence of the devil. The principle of evil is therefore the principle of negative or uncontrolled and unregenerated desire. Now it sometimes happens that where the desire nature is particularly strong, where the skandhas, as we described them in a previous series of talks on Buddhist philosophy and rebirth, where the skandhas have built tremendously aggressive forms in the kamarupa, or in the desire body. If such condition exists, the desires may and do gain in intensity to become a tremendous problem to the individual who passes through this region of desire, or region of illusion. Now, as the physical body is dropped after an appropriate period of life, so the entity or being must also ultimately depart from the kamarupa, which is a vehicle just as much as the body is. Having passed through the purgatorial phase of this matter, he then approaches the higher phases of emotion, or the devachanic plane, and gradually he moves through the entire sphere of desire, exhausting its potentials, passing from infancy to youth, maturity and age, on the level of desire, just as he has previously done so on the physical level. At the end of a certain period of time, therefore, he departs from the desire body and passes into the next higher vehicle, or the rupa manas, the mental form. When he dies out of the kama rupa, or desire body, this body is not subject to the services of what we would term today adequate undertaking facilities. We don't have them over there. A body or vehicle above the physical does not pass through funeral services and the like. What happens with it is that it gradually disintegrates within its own field, when it is no longer held together by the will and yoga of the being in the body. The etheric body naturally begins to disintegrate within 48 to 72 hours. And therefore, its actual process of disintegration is measured in terms of the deterioration and decomposition of the physical body. The kamarupa, however, does not so rapidly dissipate. And we have a very elaborate group of stories, legends, myths, and accounts in the various religions of the East and the ancient world concerning the kamarupa and what happens to it. This body of desire, after the entity is no longer inhabiting it, naturally begins the process of dying. But because of the extreme subtlety of the element in which it functions, and because of the peculiar structure which itself possesses, this disintegration is not rapid nor immediate, but takes a considerable period of time. This is a time in which the great sphere in which this body exists, the substance or the chemic material of nature, begins the process of corrupting the artificial vehicle which has been set up in it. The parallel to this might be the processes of nature closing in on the buried body in the earth. The physical body of man gradually disintegrates as the result of nature equipping itself with numerous forces to gradually destroy the remaining fleshy part of the physical organism. In the level of kama, this also takes place, and a complete system of forces operating in the kamic world begin the slow process of breaking down this body. They do it by variously attacking it, and they do it also by gradually absorbing its various elements and vital components. This gives rise to a series of very interesting symbols, myths, and legends. Perhaps you may have seen a Chinese painting of the Last Judgment, or a picture from some old Hindu religious work showing tormented souls in hell. Here you will find all kinds of beings, apparently human souls, that are being boiled in vats of oil and cut apart and variously tormented and tortured. Actually, the Indian philosophy tells us that this represents the gradual disintegration of the Kamarupa, and that long before this process begins, the being in it has departed. It is only an actual process of breaking down the elements of desire, the exhaustion and neutralization of the complex centers that have been set up in the emotional substance of nature. Therefore, nature, on the level of desire, moves in and begins to break up fears, break up hates, break up all the complexes and neuroses that have been set up in this body. It does so, however, after the entity has passed through certain experiences and departed from that vehicle. As these different vices or excesses of emotion are referred to as the seven deadly sins, the various deities are supposed to go to work on these sins and punish them. Actually, this punishment is the neutralization of this sphere, or the reduction of the emotional substance, so that it is again available for new emotional bodies, which the other human beings, or various forms in nature, must call upon. Just as the earth, having reduced forms to itself, is again available for use in the reconstruction of new bodies. This, in turn, leads to another series of interesting thoughts. Suppose the intensity of the emotional nature is so great that after the death of the individual, and he has remained, we will say, in the complex of Kamaloka and Devachan for the normal cycle of about 150 years, that he then passes on, leaving behind him this shell. This shell, however, is not exactly merely a dead carcass floating around. It is really an animate carcass, because it is still completely motivated and vitalized by the desire substance, which is its principle. It is therefore a creature with desire, but without mind, consciousness, or soul, because these have gone on to other experiences. It may, however, continue for some time as a comparatively animate thing, because every vehicle of man has a certain consciousness of its own, in addition to the consciousness that is bestowed upon it for the superior part. Let us assume, therefore, that an individual has had a particularly tempestuous emotional life, that he has succeeded in going through his 70 years or more without ever having controlled an emotion, or very nearly that, that he has been a complete victim of his appetites and his animal instincts all the way along, that he has lived almost totally for sensory gratification, and that in this gratification he has not hesitated to damage the rights, privileges, lives, the consciousness of other persons. In other words, he has been a rather unpleasant character of an intense emotional type. Now, it is very possible that after the entity departs into the lower or rupa manas, or mental body, which is that beyond, above, and within the desire body, that this body, which he has left behind, will not disintegrate even as rapidly as might normally be expected. The intensities within it have almost embalmed it. The emotional structure has become so dominant and so completely powerful that its endurance may be considerable. Now, there is an Indian belief, for example, that when this entity, having completed the cycle and entered into the rebirth cycle, and descending again, begins to build a new emotional body to live in the next incarnation, that it may do so before the old one has disintegrated completely. This is the mystery of the so-called dead planet, or the lost planet, or the dead star. For it is said that under such conditions, the old karmic body becomes what Lord Lytton calls in his books the dweller on the threshold. It becomes the impairment, or becomes the obstacle
to the rebirth of the individual because of the tremendous intensities which have not been exhausted within it. This subject is a rather large one. We can only touch on it. But it is one phase of the study of the activities of the karmic structure. Now also, we know that apart from such an excessive state of affairs, that the desires of the average person do become troublesome. We know also that desires and the consequences of desires, particularly in terms of suffering, are to a measure blunted by the fact that the desire vibration has to move through physical matter. And therefore, our desires are not nearly as intense while we are embodied as they would be if we did not have this physical vehicle. Because the attunement, though adequate for our ordinary need, is not as perfect as we might perhaps desire or for which we might be thankful. As a result of this, the intensities of our own emotional actions and reactions are greater after the physical body has been discarded. The individual, therefore, having passed into the Kamarupa, becomes, so to say, a citizen located and polarized within the field of his own desires. For him now, there is no physical break upon desire. There is no resistance from physical circumstances. Environment no longer restrains or limits. And the absence of body makes these desires infinitely more intense and clear, even as is often the case in dream symbolism. The person then is said to be susceptible to what we call purgatory. For purgatory is nothing more or less than living in the total atmosphere of your own desires. Living in the animosities, antagonisms, and antipathies which you have allowed to flow through you toward others. But now you must sort of stew in them. There is no escape, no way out, no evasion. The Kamaloka, or world of desire, looks, acts, and is exactly the way you feel about everything. This could easily mean that a suspicious person would chase shadows forever in this dark shadow world. That a jealous person would be devoured by jealousy indefinitely. There's the story of the old Egyptian moneylender who put up his stand and his scales at the entrance of Kamaloka and proceeded to lend money to lost souls who were never able to pay, which was a great torment to him, but he could never stop doing it. Then there is, of course, the story in Dante about the men rolling the bags of gold uphill, and every time they almost got them to the top, the bags rolled back and they had to start over again. The squirrel cage of desire. Things going round and round but never going anywhere. The individual constantly and continuously under the pressure of his own feelings, under the pressure of his own unregenerate or untransmuted impulses. Impulses that can become infinitely more intense until the person staggers about, as the old classics say, intoxicated with desire. Under such conditions, excesses of desire usually being negative, it would be rather evident that the being would not have a particularly happy time. The purpose for the entire experience, of course, is to exhaust as much as possible of the desire factor in the interval between re-embodiment. The purpose being that the individual should gradually learn that these intensities are not only unreasonable but unreal, and that man should discover that the universe he lives in, regardless of its factual nature, is always colored by what he believes, what he thinks, and how he feels. Therefore, it is essential to his own good that he thinks good thoughts, feels kindly about everything, and holds only such beliefs as he can live with in an intimate association with his own nature. Here we again see something of the pattern in the escapist tendencies of modern man, who fears to live with himself, seeks all kinds of divertments in order to escape this constant association with himself. In Kamaloka, of course, he is with himself. He is very near himself all the time. And he must live with the self that he is. He must put up with the things himself which he has made others put up with here in the physical world. So this body becomes a very valuable lesson ground. For in it, man finally must experience the causes and the consequences of every emotion that flows into objective expression. The refinement and regeneration of these emotions is therefore a very important phase of man's life. Referring again to the idea of the magic garden, of the astral light of the European transcendentalists, we are reminded of the enchanted garden of Klingsor the magician in the opera of Parsifal. Here we have the story of the astral light, or the story of the Kamarupic illusion. This is the one mysterious world of beautiful flowers, around the stem of each of which is twisted a poisonous serpent. This is also, according to the Hindu philosophy, the graveyard of would-be yogis. For the reason that man, attempting internalization, attempting to seek for truth within himself, must find various means of conveying his consciousness through this wonderland of things that are not so. And as the slightest inclination makes anything appear to be so, this is the world of wish fulfillment. Anything we want is there. Anything we expect is so. But it is only a dream. And in this world, or in this stage of things, it is perfectly conceivable that the individual should follow will-o'-the-wisps indefinitely. That is the reason why in Buddhism there is such a tremendous emphasis upon desirelessness. Because it is the only way in which man can pass the mystery of the dark moon without being hopelessly involved in excessive ideas. We find this also well exemplified in the physical life of man, where various psychical and mystical experiences are usually exaggerated far beyond even their probable content. The individual says, "I saw it, I know it is so." But in this mystery of the astral light, the things we see are not so. The things we hear are not so. Because they are nothing more or less than our own wishes. And any dishonest wish of ours will produce another delusion. This in turn becomes manifested through into the physical life again, where our wishful thinking makes us friends and enemies, builds lives and ruins them, and causes us to start out on innumerable adventures of knight-errantry as ill-considered as those of Don Quixote de la Mancha. Every time that we go out lancing windmills, it is because we have become the servants of some illusion within ourselves. The Indian yogi and sannyasin therefore emphasizes the tremendous importance of the desireless search for reality. That the individual can have neither hope nor fear, that he can believe neither good nor evil, but that he must sustain a complete suspension of judgment while he moves through this strange wonderland of light and color and sound. All these problems of illusion do come back to us in psychology again, because most persons are dominated by illusions of some kind. And lots of people feel that their illusions are what are keeping them alive. But without the illusion, nothing would be worthwhile. Actually, this is not true. Because in every illusion, there is something less than the truth. The truth is always greater than any illusion that we can possibly hold concerning it. But as the desire world, or the sphere of the Kamarupa in man, not only gives us pictures, but it paints us portraits. It can cause things to be completely visible, both to the internal and through projection, sometimes even apparently to the external perceptions. It can cause us to become lost in a dream, so that we no longer know where it begins or where it ends, where we are no longer able to tell whether the waking part is real or whether the dream is real. And in this problem, of course, it is obvious that the moment we start to follow one of these will-o'-the-wisps, the moment the dream becomes apparently more real, the moment the thing hoped for apparently materializes before us, the dreaming, the hoping, and the imagining are intensified until the circle becomes ever more vicious. And somewhere in the subject, we lose the entire proportion and dimension of truth. Man is not left, however, to this device. And in order that the Kamarupa may not control, he has been given a mind, an organizing power of reason, by means of which he can weigh and estimate the results of intensity. Yet his emotional life is old and rich and valuable and important. It is a very useful servant, but a tyrannical master. It is something which, properly understood, bestows progress, and when improperly understood, binds man to a purgatory. Now the Kamarupa represents the lower part of this emotion complex in man. That part which, as we have said, is likened to the astral body. Yet man has an entirely different group of emotions also. And these are the ones that are brought into play in the higher levels of the body of desire. And these are related to the devachanic sphere of insight or emotional consciousness. We can, for example, recognize emotions which by their very nature are sublimated to a very high degree. We have not only man's desire to dominate the world, we have another kind of desire, the simple desire of a Dr. Schweitzer to help other human beings. We have not only the individual whose desires are centered on a beefsteak, we have a Beethoven whose desires are centered in the abstract sphere of the creative arts. We have the materialist and we have the Michelangelo. We have the man who is essentially devoted to accumulation, and we have some saintly person who is perfectly willing to sacrifice all worldly security in the service of the truth as he understands it. Now, this is very tricky, however, because there have been a great many persons who have been sincerely following illusion. And that is where your peculiarity of your Kamarupic sphere or body is noted particularly. The individual can honestly follow a false light, and he can dishonestly follow a true light. This is due, again, to, however, the simple or pure quality of the emotional agent. Wherever an individual is deluded for any reason or on any condition, it is because of the operation of the skandhas within himself. No individual who is honestly unselfish can be deluded. But find the person. Find the individual whose motives are unconditioned by self-interest. Now, it would be apparently very hard to find such a person. We find, however, that the degree of such involvement differs with all persons. Some are almost completely dominated by self-interest, and in others it is so attenuated that they would not recognize it themselves. So we have a sliding scale on this problem, in which some are far more noble in their desires than others. And therefore, while self-interest is not absent, it is variously sublimated. And it is because of the fact that the sublimations of self-interest reach a degree in which the refinement of the emotions causes the emotional reaction to turn, so that instead of the person being plagued from within himself by his desires, he is blessed by them. When such an occurrence happens, we may assume that the ego, as Dante, has now passed into the Paradiso, or the paradise. Now, paradise is not heaven. The paradise of Buddhism, Sukhavati, is a place of reward for the constructive use of desire. It is not a sphere of desirelessness. It is not the parinirvana of the ultimate liberation. It is, however, the place in which, or the condition in which, the nobility of desire brings a conditioned and qualified degree of happiness. It is not absolute happiness. Beethoven was not absolutely happy by any means. Neither was Wagner or Michelangelo or Leonardo. They had great satisfaction, undoubtedly, in a strange, selfish way, in the things that they did. They also had great satisfaction in the creativity which they released, and to a degree, undoubtedly, in the heritage which they left to others of beauty, of art, of music, and of fine things. These persons were sensitive. As individuals, they were both good and bad, as all human beings are. But there were certain sensitivities, certain values, which also had to have their consequences, had to have their fulfillments. And slowly, as the sublimation of emotion takes place, and the forms of its expression become less and less gross, there is this constant increase of positive emotional content. It is like the polarization of love and passion, one of which, passion, brings with it nearly always misery, whereas true love, even with great sorrow, finds great happiness. And these things are strangely intermingled. Great love does not break the cycle of the nidanas, or the causal sequences of cause and consequence, but it does give the individual a measure of fulfillment commensurate with the quality of the emotion which he has expressed. It is again cause and effect. It is equal. It is just. It is reasonable. But just as it is reasonable for us to be punished for some things, it is also reasonable for us to be recognized or rewarded for other things. Now, we must realize that in this case, in the Indian philosophy, there is no arbitrary system of punishments and rewards. There is no book in which the record is kept. There is no angel or demon who administers sidereal justice.